The Pat Kenny Show.
With the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
When the young Richie Sadler was propelled into the world of professional soccer, he didn't expect that it would end abruptly. At the age of 24, he sustained a career-ending injury, and this was followed by a downward spiral of drink and drugs. Now, he has written about all of this in his new memoir, which is brilliantly written, I have to say. It's called Recovering, and he talks about every aspect of his life. It is the most searingly frank book that I've read in a long time. Richie, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. How are you doing?
Why did you do it? Why did you write it?
I had been approached several times over the last few years by various publishers or literary agents proposing the idea, and I would learn a little bit about the process every time I'd meet them. I'd meet them for a coffee, but yeah. I never kind of felt comfortable enough to do it in the way that I think I know I would do it if I eventually did it. I was going to go all in on this. I've read lots of books where you get to the end of it and you know a bit more about the matches that people played in or the personalities that they knew, but you don't really know much about them. And I just thought, I don't want this to be a book about goals I scored or matches we won or lost or drew. It was going to be a very different approach. And I just thought, you know what? Like, personally, I'm very comfortable with where I am, where I've been, what I've gone through. And I felt ready to write it. And I thought I'd enjoy it. And I really did enjoy it. It was really intense. It was really difficult. It was like really challenging in parts, but it was lovely as well, actually, to be able to recall and write about stuff I've been through, which was really difficult and hard, and then be able to sit here and go, I feel nothing like that now. Like my life is so different.
There
to
are
those
so
moments.
Many questions that come out of the book. For example, let's start at the beginning. Young footballer,
mm-hmm.
And every kid wants to play for Ireland and wants to get a break and play in England and maybe the Premiership.
Mm.
That's great. How did it happen for you? You were obviously a very talented young footballer.
So I ended up playing for very few local clubs, and I ended up playing for Belvedere, which is a team in Fairview Park. And a scout, the process is quite straightforward. If someone sees you playing and they like what they see, they'll approach you and ask you to go on trial. So that happened to me. So I went on trial to England to a couple of clubs and at the age of 15 and 16, and Millwall offered me a contract. And I stayed to do my leaving cert. And then within a month of doing the leaving cert, I moved to England. So I was the age of 17. This is back in mid-90s.
Yeah. No transition 96. Year, just fifth year, sixth yeah. year, do the leaving cert, off you go.
Yeah, no, we had the option to do the transition year. We were one of the first years and I thought, this is going to delay my departure to England. I was like the
And they
focus.
Were happy to let you do your exams and wait for you.
Well, actually, I did something. I'm kind of surprised and amazed I did it. At the age of 15, I was offered at the age of 16, I was offered a 2-year deal by Millwall. But it would have meant going over in the summer of fifth year, which meant I would go over without my leaving cert. And I got really good advice by my managers at the time. They said, you know, if they want you now, like they'll want you in a year, and you're better off going over with a leaving cert in your back pocket. You've no idea where this is going to go.
As it turned out, that was very important.
It was brilliant. So I ended up staying.
Okay, so you go over at 17, and I see it in the book. And there's a picture of it as well. You bought your first house at the age of 19.
I did.
Now, there are kids today in their 30s thinking, I'll never buy a house.
Mm.
So that's how big it was to be a professional footballer.
Yeah, it was all these kind of things just became normal, or you kind of just take it in your stride or whatever.
It's what you do.
Yeah, it's because the other lads I was playing with. When you're a footballer, actually, you're kind of encouraged to keep your circle of friends as small as possible and as footballer dominated as possible, because there's a sense that anyone outside the world of football might be a negative influence. They have a different lifestyle. They might have different ideas about how to approach each weekend. And you've kind of got to be as focused or as disciplined as you
can. I mean, back in the day, people like Alex Ferguson would want a young fella to be with a landlady rather than in their own flat or house or whatever. And they would even get them married off quite young if they could, to give them stability.
Yeah, there is that thing in football where you think, well, if we can get them domesticated and settled, that'll keep them in over the weekend and they will be better footballers as a result, because there'll be less chaos in their life. At Millwall, it was kind of a work hard, play hard.
Yeah.
That was the culture. And we did really work hard and we did really play hard. And it was a tough environment, but it was a lot of fun, like really enjoyable. You know, you're doing what you love to do every day.
Yeah. Now, one of the things was the women. Mm-hmm. Loads of. No shortage of.
It was... Do you know what? It was only when friends of mine from Dublin would come over and they would make observations. And we'd be out on a Saturday night and they didn't see these scenes in Dublin. Where we would be standing out in a bar or wherever, and there would be girls who would deliberately position themselves next to us and deliberately bump into us or try to start a conversation or bump into you when you're on your way to the Jackson. And it was...
And they were obviously available.
Well, did you have any sex education in school when you grew up?
Not a lot.
What conversations did you have around sex when you were a teenager with anyone?
Let me tell you this. In the Christian Brothers, when we were in fifth year, we were given a little book. And in this book, it said, where people have sex together, the boy puts where his water comes from into where the girl's water comes from.
That was the phrase?
That was the phrase.
Any scope for asking questions? Or getting...
Not at all. Embarrassment all round.
Right. So I wouldn't have had any formal discussions in school or otherwise with anyone about what relationships or sex entail at all. But then I went over to England.
Crash course.
Yeah. And I think sometimes when I hear people talk about footballer culture or professional sport culture, they kind of think... There's a failure to appreciate actually what the landscape looks like. Everyone, the players and women, are just kind of just seen as potential sex partners.
Yeah, and you would have had sex with a girl who'd had sex maybe with one of your mates. I mean, that wouldn't have been unusual.
Again, yeah, and when you hear, when my friends would come over, like they would hear things said in conversation or they would observe things in nights out and they said, is that what this is like all the time? And it was in those moments where you go, all right, yeah, this isn't... I don't think this happens anywhere else, but when you're in this world, it just becomes the norm.
Yeah. And now I know you're a great advocate of consent classes and people understanding before they embark on their sexual adventures.
Probably informed by a lot of my earlier experiences, yeah, to be honest, which I've never really publicly spoken about before. But I think and this is not a particularly original thing to say, but education is helpful. Like having open conversations can be beneficial. And this is an... Sex is particularly an area where I don't really know where to go with it or what to say, because if you say anything open, you'll be judged. If I say anything open, I could be judged. And a man who talks about, you know, his sexual desires, he's only after one thing. If a woman talks about her sexual desires, she'd be brandished all sorts of names. So I don't really know where to go with it. So it's I think it's great when you can start early to normalise conversations about these topics.
On the footballing side and on the, you know, the recreational side, things were going fantastically. You got a call up to play for Ireland. You got to play in a friendly. And then catastrophe. What happened?
I got a call up. I got a call which I would have dreamt about getting. For as long as I knew there was an Ireland team since a kid, I thought, imagine what it must feel like to get that call up. So I got that call in January 2002 to play in a game in February 2002, and I got about 20 minutes in the game, and then 3 weeks later I hurt my hip and didn't recover. And the timing of those two things, or the closeness of them, for years I tormented myself with that. That, oh yeah, God, haven't I the most unlucky fella ever? I was just about to launch myself into a certain area and it was just taken from me. And I hammered myself and the world and the universe, yeah,
and
God.
You still have dreams. I was reading the book, you know, that at a time it was Trapattoni would call you up, even though you would have been long retired for your age and so on. But you get the call back finally to play for Ireland.
I did, yeah. Like years after, like I'm well retired at this stage. It was 2003 when I finished. I tried to come back 2 years later. So it's 2006 was the last time I ever set foot in a professional football club with a view to playing football. But I would often have dreams, you're right, where I'm called up again to play for Ireland. Like this, it's like my mind still hasn't accepted it. Somewhere in my mind hasn't accepted
it. And
even
now, as a pundit, you still get that dream with Mick McCarthy this time.
Yeah, I had this weird thing. When Mick got the job, I did, like, Trapattoni was replaced by Mick, and I was like, I'm getting the call up by Mick McCarthy again.
The business of your education, which became so important, you had to find another career. Now, there's a whole downward spiral, which with cocaine and drink and all the rest of it, we'll park that. But the fact that you found a new direction, and as a psychotherapist.
the most unlikeliest of directions that you could have described to me a decade earlier. I mean, if you can imagine the environment of Millwall at professional football, it's a world away from the environment of supporting people with their mental health and psychotherapy. But I got a lot of benefit myself as a client of therapy, and I just, there was something that drew me into the process. And 7 or 8 years after I retired, I just took a punt. You know, when you just follow a gut feeling, and I did a course around the corner at Dublin Business School for 2 years, a HDIP, and then did a 2 year master's, and then I started seeing clients from 2014, and I loved it.
Like, it just was right.
I loved it. Like I work with teenagers for the last few years, but honestly, there are moments that are exactly like the moments I had in a different sphere of football, where you just sit there and go, I can't believe I'm doing this, and I'm getting paid to do this. I love this. Or you go to bed and you go, I can't wait to do this tomorrow.
Now, people would envy you in your role as a pundit, and yet you felt you were an imposter when you started that out.
Well, do you know what? There's a kind of a thing in, and maybe it's in other areas of public discussion, that there's like a hierarchy. And in order to have a certain position on a certain panel, you need to have a status. And in the world of football, how you get a status is you perform on a pitch. So if you have 100 caps and I have 2, they listen to you and not me. That kind of, to simplify it. When I was being put in a panel, like with John Giles and Liam Brady, like two of, you know, you can argue this all day long, but they're probably two of the best 3 or 4 players have ever been produced. And their minds work the way they are, and they're established leaders in this field. And then I rock up next to them. I think Bill O'Hurley, he's the presenter, and I'm watching these people from the age of 10. And I'm like, and I've played 20 minutes, not even, of a friendly that no one would remember, and never played in the Premier League. Why the hell am I being given a platform alongside someone like John or someone like Liam? And I struggled with that for ages. And then after a while, and they were great initially, and after a while I kind of just realised, you know what, everyone I know really assertively and in a very opinionated way gives their views on football, and they've never kicked the ball.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, just get over that. Just go into RTE, give your tuppence and go home, and just let go of the hang-ups and all.
Jose
that.
Never played at the highest level, so.
You know, there's all those kind of things. I thought, well, just have a very different approach, really, to myself. And then when I did that, I had a different approach to everything that I did.
Yeah. Well, there is so much in the book. As I said, it's a searingly honest book, but it's very easy to read. I mean, it's a page turner. So
well,
you have another string to your bow, that of a writer.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting used to being called an author. It's only out since last Friday. I find that bit the most bizarre.
Well, it's called Recovering. It's in all good bookshops now. It's priced in hardback, $24.99, published by Gill Books, and it's author and psychotherapist and pundit and former soccer star, Richie Sadlier. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Pat.